Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You know by now that my name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and president of Sierra Steel Trading here in San Francisco. I'll be your host for today's program. We also welcome our listening audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Reva Gambert. For someone who grew up in an assimilated home without any urging or direction from her family to celebrate Jewish religion or culture, and where even the candles to celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah were not lit, Reva Gambert did find Judaism. And through her favorite uncle visiting from Italy, she discovered Jewish literature. And to quote Reva, she said, "Books led me on a personal journey of discovery that gave me knowledge and self-esteem. The deliverance of high-quality cultural experiences that showcase the many different ways of Jewish involvement can open doors that lead to further Jewish education, greater affiliation, and a more meaningful connection." Currently, Reva is the director of the Jewish Federation of the East Bay's Israel Center, the director of the East Bay International Jewish Film Festival, and for more than a decade, a teacher and a lecturer on East Bay and Israeli film-related topics. So now's the right time to please give a warm welcome to Reva Gambert.
And thank you for inviting me. Can you hear me? Yes? Thank you. As story begins, and you should know the topic is Harry and Zion, so we start there. As story begins on April 12, 1945, when Harry S. Truman, the vice president for just 73 days, is enjoying a sip of bourbon with Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn on Capitol Hill in Room 9, which Rayburn affectionately called his Department of Education, when a message came to Truman asking him to go to the White House. He got there, and he was escorted to the second floor. If you know the date of April 12th, you can imagine why he was there, though he thought at the time that he was going to be invited to go to a state funeral, which vice presidents sometimes do, or perhaps greet a visiting dignitary at this important time towards the end of World War II. FDR was relaxing, recovering from his travels at Yalta in Warm Springs, Georgia. But when he reached the second floor, he was surprised not to see FDR having arrived earlier, which he assumed, but rather distraught Eleanor Roosevelt. "The president is dead," she said to Truman. "What can I do for you?" Harry responded. "No, Harry, it's what we can do for you, for you're the one in trouble now." There were many people in the United States, especially in Washington, who thought that perhaps America was in trouble because Truman would not have been someone who would have been picked at the convention just some months before as a wartime president. He had not been a great general in World War I, though he was an officer. He was not known for his foreign policy acumen. He had been a senator in Missouri. But he had been chosen because he was in Henry Wallace, who at this time was considered far too left to be a potential president, Roosevelt being weaker and weaker, and some people realized he could die in office during his fourth term because Wallace had been very, very progressive, and we were now facing in the United States another war with the Soviet Union, the Cold War. Truman, however, is now thought of as one of our best presidents, and during his time in office, dealt with many, many significant foreign policy challenges, certainly ending World War II, the Berlin airlift, the expansionist aims of the Soviet Union, not just in Eastern Europe, but in Iran, in Greece, in Turkey, in Libya, a flare-up in Syria, the faltering economy in Western Europe, the Marshall Plan, and the Korean War. But of all these things, his daughter commented that the most pressing and the most challenging, perhaps the most irritating to him, though eventually something that pleased him in his decision-making capacity, was the issue of the partition of Palestine. So before we talk about what he did during his administration, let's look at what he brought to the table in his own personal background and what he inherited, so to speak. Truman was born in the 1880s in Missouri. He knew a lot about farming, which would later influence his relationship with a leading Zionist leader, Chaim Weizmann, who was a scientist and could share with Truman some of the things being done in Palestine, which was not a country but a region under British control at the time. He also was a Baptist and was encouraged and allegedly did read the Bible dozens of times before he was 15 years old. He did not come from a rich family. His family fortune went up and down, but not very up. So at the time, they'd say he was on the wrong side of the tracks, which affected him and his own self-esteem and ego issues. According to a biographer, because he wore glasses as a very young child, which was not the norm in the 1880s and 1890s, he was often bullied. And it didn't help that he studied a lot and played piano. So later on, he really took offense, as any of us would, but especially when people, or when he felt that people were bullying him, which often happened during these years of making decisions about Palestine, or when he was later manipulated, or so he felt, by other individuals. And sometimes it got his backup, so to speak. He inherited Palestine from the British, not actually, of course, inheriting it legally or anything, but he had to deal with Palestine, a region under British control. It was called the Mandate for Palestine, which Britain got at the end of World War I, in a process which someone who cynically called it France and England carving up the carcass of the Turk, the Ottoman Empire. And the mandate was for Britain to build up Palestine with Jewish immigration so there could be a Jewish national home. The British were not eager to do this, and with a series of white papers, severely restricted Jewish immigration in the 20s and 30s. The worst or most serious of the white papers was that in 1939, just before World War II was going to begin in September. And the Jewish immigration, the getting of legal visas, was cut so little that it was very hard for Jews trying to get out of Europe at a time when people knew that a whirlwind of darkness was going to descend quickly. It was very hard for them to get to Palestine, and we know the results. Britain kept this white paper restriction through the war and even after the war was over, which we'll talk about in a little while. He inherited from the State Department a very negative feeling towards the creation of a Jewish state, which they felt would isolate the Arab world, the Muslim world, from both Great Britain and America, push the Arab world towards the Soviet Union, something which the State Department thought was very, very dangerous at this time of an approaching Cold War. And of course, it could cut off or limit oil to Western Europe, which would need it for recovering of the economy after the war, and in the United States. One State Department pundit said that if indeed America supported a Jewish state and the Arab world retaliated with cutting back oil, we'd have to go back to a model Ford, who knows what they were many years ago, the early cars with very little energy, because we could not have enough oil to support the more zippier cars that were around in the 1940s. They also were afraid that a Jewish state would become a haven for communists and even a communist state, that many Jews were going to sneak in from the Soviet Union to Palestine, and that would be very dangerous for American interests. From FDR, he inherited a vacillating policy. There were times when President Roosevelt felt or voiced his support for a Jewish state, especially to such Jewish Zionist leaders as Rabbi Weiss, who you may have heard of, and Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver of the American Jewish Congress. And he would say, after the war, after World War II, I will be more public in my support for a Jewish state in Palestine. And yet, just around Valentine's Day in 1945, after leaving Yalta, President Roosevelt flew to the Suez Canal area and was brought to the American ship USS Quincy. And there he was to meet, and he was very, very tired at this time and not very healthy, three world leaders, Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, King Farouk of Egypt, and Ibn Saud, the King of Saudi Arabia. It was a famous meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia. Roosevelt had said to several of his close associates that he was going to talk about creation of a small Jewish state, and he hoped that Saudi Arabia would agree to it. After all, Saudi Arabia was much larger, the Arab countries were vast in size, and a small Jewish state could be acceptable, he thought, and also there would be foreign aid to Arab states and Saudi Arabia from the United States, military support, etc. But Ibn Saud, who had to be hoisted on deck because he was very frail. In fact, Roosevelt gave him as a presidential gift a modern wheelchair. And FDR got in return, I think, sort of a gold and jewel-encrusted saber as a gift. Ibn Saud was not happy with hearing this news and protested and said the Arab world would never accept a Jewish state anywhere, no matter what size. And FDR, to the king, and later on in a press conference, seemed to side with the king of Saudi Arabia. In it, he said, we will not, America, do anything without first consulting with the Arab world and with the Jewish people in Palestine. But it sort of said there could be a veto if the Arab world said no. And in the press conference that FDR gave when he returned to Washington, he had said something which was not very good politically, and his political advisers shuddered. He said, I've learned more from my brief conversation with the king of Saudi Arabia than in all the letters I've gotten on the issue of the Muslim world, the Arab world, and the Jewish question in years prior. This was not a very happy thing to hear by American Jews or by Christian Zionists, of whom there were millions in the United States. And one senator in the United States said, to say that the king of Saudi Arabia could teach FDR more than in other correspondence about the Jewish question, presumably about Palestine and the creation of a Jewish state, well, I believe that FDR's dog Fowler knows more about the Jewish question. But tragically, FDR died very soon thereafter, and he never made more decisions about either a Jewish state, yes, or a Jewish state, no, leaving it up in the air, at least as far as American Zionists were concerned. One of the first things Truman did in regard to the issue of Palestine was to really feel a great amount of empathy for those survivors of the Holocaust. There were more than 250,000 who were in displaced persons camps in Europe. And he sent the dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, anyone from there? No. Earl Harrison, to go to Europe and to interview survivors and see where they wanted to go. Both Great Britain and the State Department were pressing that survivors of the Holocaust, those who had left the camps, who had seen their families wiped out, should return to Poland or Germany or Austria, Czechoslovakia, etc. And when people said, but that's where we experienced anti-Semitism and sometimes collaboration with the SS, with the Third Reich, the answer was, well, the UN will help solve anti-Semitism. Or perhaps you can go to some more remote area such as Eritrea in Africa or Ecuador or parts of the Soviet Union or the Amazonian rainforest, which is something most wonderful places. But they wanted to go, Harrison found out, to a Jewish state in Palestine, and at least at first to Palestine, and hopefully it would become an independent country. Because of this report, Truman immediately asked the British government, under the new government of Clement Attlee and the foreign minister, Bevin, to tear up the white paper, though he may have not said it in those words. He said, "We request that 100,000 Jews from these displaced persons camps, who have been traumatized by their years of horror during World War II, who are still mentally and emotionally shaken up and in pain, go to Palestine." And he expected an immediate, yes, of course, they've been suffering, and why not? Certainly very few Jews at all could have immigrated during World War II, so this could have been possible. And he expected the answer to come very quickly. But it was more than 2 weeks when the answer came from the British government, and the answer was no. The white paper still stands. There is a vigorous visa requirement, restrictions, and people will have to wait their turn to come in. Unfortunately, at this time, some people, especially Bevin, said some comments, and I understand he wasn't an anti-Semite, but he said certain things which really sounded very callous. Things like, well, if you have Jews who survived the Shoah, the Holocaust, go first in line to leave the displaced persons camps, maybe there'd be greater anti-Semitism. Of course, these people had experienced horrible anti-Semitism of an obscene amount, so his words were very, very cruelly received. In addition, later on, while we're speaking of Bevin, he said about Truman, the reason why Truman is pushing for 100,000 Jews to go to Palestine is that he doesn't want them in New York City. Because of these statements, and because Britain had not said yes to Truman's very humanitarian request, there began to be a coolness in relations between Great Britain and the United States. And Great Britain was looking to get favorable loans at this time after the war, when there was a very difficult economic situation in Great Britain. And so eventually Great Britain suggested that there be a committee to look at the situation and decide how do you bring 100,000 Jews out of the displaced persons camps, who would secure them during their voyage, who would pay for them, et cetera, et cetera. Truman agreed, and it was called the Anglo-American Committee or Commission of Inquiry. And it met in 1946, it went to Europe, it went to the Middle East, and after months they issued a report, which Truman found very, very favorable and very fair. Britain did not like it. The Jews in Palestine and the United States, who were Zionists, did not criticize Truman too much for supporting it, because they liked the fact that the 100,000 Jews could go to Palestine, but they didn't like one other aspect of this proposal or plan, and the Arab world did not like it at all. The plan said, or the report said, 100,000 Jews should be able to go immediately, but there should not be either an Arab state in Palestine or a Jewish state. This would have to be worked on. Truman, when he said he liked it, received a huge amount of criticism, because not because of the 100,000, which he thought was a wonderful idea, that he had wanted that and was getting what he had wanted and dreamed of, but because he got criticized because these committee members did not say there should be a Jewish state as soon as possible. Soon, there was another committee sent, a much smaller one, to look at what can you do with 100,000, how do you get them out of Europe, and what type of state could you create if it isn't Arab or Jewish? How could the UN be involved? What should the world do? This was called the Morrison-Grady plan, a proposal, and Truman again liked it. The British loved it, and the Arabs and Jews didn't like it. I gave you a map when you came in. It doesn't say that plan, but you can look at what Palestine was in the map that you have. The map that you have is actually the 1947 plan for the partition of Palestine that the UN voted on November 29th. But before that, there was another proposal, the Morrison-Grady one, which said there should be an independent state, but a federation, sort of like a Switzerland, with provinces or cantons. The biggest one would belong to the biggest province, Great Britain. 50% of the land around Jerusalem and the Negev, the southern part of what is today Israel, would be controlled by Great Britain. The Arabs in Palestine would have 33% approximately, and around the areas where the majority of Arab Palestinians lived. And then, if you can count the rest, is 17% would be a Jewish province of basically around where Jewish Palestinians lived. And I say Jewish Palestinians because if you live there as a Jew, as a Christian, as a Muslim, whatever your background, ethnicity, religion, you were a Palestinian of a different religion or ethnicity. The Jews didn't like a postage-size stamp area, which only had a semi-autonomous nature. The Arabs didn't like it. They wanted Palestine entirely Arab, and they didn't want to be semi-autonomous. England liked it because England was in charge of the entire region in many ways, of immigration, foreign policy, taxation, things that a country would be in charge of. Truman liked it because with this came an immediate, over 100,000 Jews could come into the country. And he got a lot of political flack in the United States because of this. People felt that a country 30 by 50 miles for a Jewish state was far too small. After all, there were all these people who had survived the Shoah who had said they want to come here. And many Jews and many other countries of the world, including Arab countries in North Africa and in Western Asia. And that was not enough, a postage-sized stamp country, to accommodate everyone who wanted to be there. Truman made a speech, therefore, many people say because of political reasons. There were midterm elections coming up in 46, and the Democratic chances were a little bit more doubtful than in previous years. And he was asked to give a speech by his political advisors on the eve of Yom Kippur, saying that he did support a Jewish state. He said it publicly. And in an adequate part of Palestine. Whether it was the word adequate wasn't adequate enough, if people were tired with Democratic, voting Democratic after so many years, it changed on Capitol Hill. And for the first time in, I believe, 18 years, the Republicans won more seats. Truman, by this time, who had been besieged by pollsters and political advisors and people on both sides, the State Department and Zionists, coming at him on this issue, he said, enough already. Don't bother me. I'm leaving it to the State Department. I'm going on to other issues, which, of course, were on his desk like this because of all the different pressing problems, both internal, domestic, with the steel workers' strike and foreign policy. 1947, England tried to get both Jews and Arabs to agree to this Morrison-Grady plan, but neither did, and the conferences and meetings went nowhere. So around February of 1947, the British went to the United Nations and said, help us decide what to do. There's escalating violence in Palestine between Jews and Arabs and everyone against the British soldiers in that region, and we're asking, decide. That spring, a special committee on Palestine, the acronym UNSCOP, was created and went to Europe and the Middle East asking people from all different dimensions, perspectives, about what to do. The result, and I don't think we have that much time, but you can ask me who these countries were, had representatives on UNSCOP. There were 11 countries. They issued a report, a majority report, on August 30th, 1947, and a minority report, both of which were penned by a man you may have heard of, Ralph Bunche. And the majority report said, the only way to solve this is not to keep a country with both sides together, but to partition Palestine. And you see what the map would look like that I've given out. There would be an Arab-Palestinian country and a Jewish-Palestinian country, and Jerusalem would be internationalized. This was eventually to be sent to the United Nations for a vote in November of 1947. The State Department did not like this. The State Department, as I said before, thought it was folly. It would isolate America and Great Britain from the Arab world. And they really worked very hard against it, giving all sorts of reasons, which I've shared, and even more ones. One of the ones, which you would hear continually through 47 and 48, was that a Jewish state would be attacked once it became independent and most likely be destroyed, or there'd be horrible casualties during this war of independence. And in order to prevent another Holocaust, the United States would have to come in, either rescue Jews and bring them outside this new state, which would then disappear and be absorbed by the Arab-Palestinian state, or just try to rescue the situation and be involved in the fighting, which would create American casualties and which also would be very expensive economically, and especially which would pull American troops away from places where the Soviet Union was trying to expand in Greece, Turkey, and other places, therefore weakening our security. What they tried to do when they couldn't stop this, couldn't roll it back totally, was to take the map that you saw and try to play with it so that those who were against having a Jewish state would say, well, thank you. The Jewish state is much smaller now because you, the State Department, you, Truman administration, have worked to make it smaller. The areas they wanted to remove from the future Jewish state was the entire Negev, which you can see the southern part of Israel, and certain areas in the northern part. And because of this, people who were very much against it, Americans, Zionists, and Jews in Palestine, decided to reach out to Truman, even though he had a hands-off policy at this time, like, leave, I don't want to deal with it. And the person they thought would be the best person to deal with it was someone he had already met. He couldn't pronounce the man's name. It was Chaim. He called him, I believe, Ham, or Cham, or something like that. It was Chaim Weizmann, the Russian-British scientist who had gone to study in England before World War I. And Truman really liked him and respected him. And he met with him. And, Weizmann was told as he walked into the office by one of the supporters of Zionism who was in the Truman administration, David K. Niles, who was a holdover from FDR's administration. He was a liaison to minority communities in the United States. Niles said to him, don't talk about why there should be a Jewish state and King David and Solomon. Don't do that. Talk about agriculture. You're a scientist. You know what the Hebrew University and this university and the kibbutzim and all the farms are doing to increase crop yields, to save water, et cetera, et cetera. Truman grew up in a farming community. He'd appreciate that. And that's what Ham Weizmann did. They had a very close relationship. Truman respected him and did not feel at all bullied or manipulated by Weizmann, who was a very gentle soul, as compared to perhaps Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver, who actually went like this in Truman's face, making Truman say, this man will never enter my office again. So Truman actually said to the State Department, leave the map as it is. Because I don't have too much time, we'll skip over to November of 1947. Right before Thanksgiving, it looked as if the partition of Palestine, which was going to be part of Resolution 181, would fail. And the vote, according to some people, was delayed purposely to get more lobbying time in so that those who supported a Jewish state would have more time to reach out to countries around the world. And this, indeed, there are many books about this, did happen. For instance, the Firestone Rubber Company, I think it has a longer name, but you know Firestone Tires, had a very close relationship with Liberia. And calls were made by Mr. Firestone to the president of Liberia saying, how are you voting? And this happened with many countries, the Philippines, and eventually the vote came to the General Assembly. It wasn't in Manhattan then. It was in Queens, where the UN was at the time, on November 29th, 1947. And the resolution to partition Palestine into two parts, Arab and Jewish, passed 33-13 with 10 abstentions and one country was absent. There was great joy in the Jewish part of Palestine among Zionists, both Christian and Jewish, but basically, the War of Independence started the next day. Violence escalated, and it was a very tense situation. Eventually, in Jerusalem, the Jewish part of Jerusalem, which is the new city, the western half did not have enough drinking water, did not have enough food. There were recipes for cakes, which had no eggs and no sugar. People had an elaborate system of recycling water because foodstuffs and water could not get to Jerusalem. The State Department tried very hard to still sabotage 181, this resolution. And one of the ways they did it was to create a push on Truman, which Truman did not appreciate, and also through journalists such as James Reston say, this new Jewish state, if it's born, will die very quickly and there'll be a catastrophe and America will have to go in to save lives. And this frightened people, even people who were the close associates inside sort of the kitchen cabinet, if you will, of David Ben-Gurion, who would later become first prime minister. There were some of his close colleagues in Palestine who were frightened to have Ben-Gurion declare Israel independent, who had heard the new Secretary of State in America, who was George Marshall, the famous war hero, say these things that we don't think the Jewish state is up to defending itself against the Arab armies. Eventually, five Arab armies did invade the new Jewish state. So there was a great amount of fear. And because of this, people were thinking about holding off the British leaving and holding off the partition, instead keeping Palestine under UN rule in a trusteeship. People who really wanted there to be a Jewish state felt that the momentum would be stopped, and though the State Department said it'll be for a few months, maybe a few years, that hopes for an independent Jewish state would be ended completely because it would be connected to Arabs and Jews agreeing, which tragically still has not happened in regard to having a Jewish state in the region. So again, people who wanted a Jewish state in the United States said, we have to bring Chaim Weizmann back because Truman may be influenced by these fears that the new Jewish state will be destroyed and again you'll have another Holocaust. But Truman did not want to deal with it and he said no. Weizmann by this time had gone back to London on his way to Palestine and he was brought back on an ocean liner to New York to wait for the call that said come to Washington. And it didn't come. Eddie Jacobson, who was a close friend since the days of World War I when he served under Truman in an artillery unit, was called in. Jacobson, and you may have heard, Truman opened up a gentleman's store in, I think it was Kansas City, which didn't succeed financially, but they kept on a friendship. And he had met Truman many times in the White House. And Eddie Jacobson was asked, could you please call your friend the president? He did and was told he's not going to welcome you to talk about Palestine. And then Truman was away vacationing, and Jacobson just went to Washington and said, I'm here. And he was invited in but said, you can't talk about Palestine. Don't talk about it. That's it. So he was brought in, and Truman again said no. And as the conversation was about to end and the watch was counting down to the end of the session, Jacobson felt the burden of Jewish history on his shoulders because there was a fear that Truman would not go along with partition and do something with the UN and say, hey, it's too dangerous. So he was looking around the Oval Office and glimpsed a small statue of Andrew Jackson, who had been a hero of Truman's, and Truman had had, while he was a senator, a much larger bronze statue of Andrew Jackson, a duplicate of the little one, put outside a post office in one of the cities in Missouri. And he pointed to the little statue and said, that's your hero. I know you've read every single book about Andrew Jackson. I have a hero too. It probably wasn't really true, but he felt this was a way to get to Truman. My hero is Chaim Weizmann. I know you've met with him. Could you meet with him again? And I hope I'm not offending anyone by what Truman allegedly said in all the books I've looked at. He finally, after pausing and digesting this, said, "Okay, you bold son of a, I'll meet with him." And they did. But Chaim Weizmann had to be brought in through a side door. They didn't have a lot of press. Truman did not want to be seen as going to one side or the other at this time. This was in March, I think it was March 18th when they met, of 1948. And the next day, it was called Black Friday by many people who supported a Jewish state, because unbeknownst to Truman, the American ambassador to the UN, Warren Austin, who did not believe there should be partition, went to the UN and gave a speech that said, "The United States no longer agrees with Resolution 181. We think it should be under a UN trusteeship and not be partitioned in May when it was on the timetable for British troops to leave." American Zionists, Jews in Palestine, Eddie Jacobson, David Niles, and also Clark Clifford, who was a very trusted aide of Truman and was a great supporter of a Jewish state. He was Presbyterian, but also a great Zionist, were shocked. The most shocked was Truman. He did not know and had not agreed that his UN ambassador should say this. Now, he may have forgotten that he had signed a contingency plan that had been created by the State Department that said if the violence cannot be controlled, if it got very, very difficult with bloodshed in Palestine, perhaps then there would be the need for a trusteeship and international control. But he hadn't made the decision that it would be on March 19th that this wording would be issued to the world. He couldn't, though, deplore what Austin had said, because to say that Austin spoke his ambassador without his agreement would weaken his position in the world. So they gave sort of a statement which was here and there. Sometime, maybe if there's increased violence, there could be a trusteeship, but it's too soon to make that statement now. This, because Truman felt it was bullying by the State Department and manipulation by people he called those striped pants boys, I think, and many others do, think pushed Truman to much more wholeheartedly believe that there should be a Jewish state, and he was going to side with that position. In any event, time is ticking. In May of 1948, a few days before the British were to leave, before Ben-Gurion would announce independence for the first time in nearly 2,000 years, George Marshall, who was Secretary of State, tried once more to convince Truman not to have a Jewish state. And in that meeting, which was sometimes called the showdown in the Oval Office, there was George Marshall, there were people from the State Department, Clark Clifford, who had come as a naval aide and now was a legal counsel, and President Truman. Marshall argued why he felt one way. Clark Clifford argued the other in support of a Jewish state. And George Marshall said, when it was obvious that Truman was going to agree with Clifford, "Mr. President, if the election was today," and this was 48, so it's going to be around the corner, "I wouldn't vote for you." However, he did say he would keep quiet. Truman was, after all, the President of the United States, and he would not go public with his objections. 2 days later, Israel was declared an independent state, and the United States was the first country to recognize this new nation. However, the recognition was de facto and not de jure. And I'm not a lawyer, but the difference I hear is that with de facto, it is we acknowledge you exist, you're a country, but we're not yet exchanging ambassadors. That would only come in the end of January 1949, when there were elections in Israel, and Ben-Gurion was officially elected prime minister. Truman later was very proud of his decision, even though he vacillated from time to time. And when a rabbi said that he was like Cyrus the Great of Persia, who was very magnanimous to all different ethnic and religious groups in the 6th century BCE, a long time ago, known to allow Jews to return to the land of Israel after the Babylonian exile, Truman was very touched. So when he was later introduced to a group of people after his administration was over in 1953, he was introduced as the man who helped create a state of Israel. He said, "What do you mean helped? I am Cyrus. I am Cyrus." Thank you.
Well, there isn't much we didn't learn about Truman and Palestine so far today, but hopefully we've got some questions here which will probe not only some of the discussion that Riva has discussed already, but maybe a few areas where she hasn't. So thanks very much to Riva Gambert for her comments today. We have a few questions that ask, was Harry Truman at all anti-Semitic? Now that sounds maybe silly based on the results that Harry Truman was able to achieve and also his early support as a senator, even from Missouri, of the Jewish people and the formation of a Jewish state eventually. But this question says, didn't Truman in his private correspondence reflect a degree of anti-Semitism, a distrust of Jews in general? And let me just add to that, Riva, if I can. In my research, I read about all the pressure from various Jewish lobby groups, Zionist groups, and so forth, that probably had a great result in terms of the state of Israel being formed. But with all the things that Truman had to do, maybe he really got upset and had enough of that.
The answer is yes and no. He was born around 1884. He was probably living in a place where there were, I do believe there was a Jewish family in his neighborhood growing up, but not many Jews. There was a lot of ignorance about other religions, other ethnic groups, other races back then. And he probably heard a lot of stereotypical things, which he assimilated. I think if he was alive today and sitting here and we said, "We think you're an anti-Semite," he would be horribly shocked. He had a great amount of empathy. However, when he was tense or agitated or someone went like this to him, I didn't mention, he received more than a million telegrams, postcards, letters about voting, about his administration supporting a Jewish state, which was a huge amount of correspondence. He got very upset and said things such as, "Jesus Christ couldn't even satisfy the Jews in his lifetime. How could I?" He said things like that. But I don't think he himself would ever have wished harm to any Jewish individual. So yes, he said things which were certainly, today's world would be considered horribly anti-Semitic and not politically correct, but I don't think he wished any Jewish individual harm. So, yes.
Okay, thanks for that. Harry Truman understood that Israel would be a dependable democracy in the Middle East. But why wasn't this as an important a fact to George Marshall and the State Department?
There was a perception that many Jews were very far left, that, of course, the Ben-Gurion government, the labor government, which was socialist, which had kibbutzim, which are some people would think communist or at least socialist, and therefore that they would be very, very partial to the Soviet Union in the advancing Cold War, which was, to mix words, heating up. And therefore, they felt that there could be support of Soviet interests. And they also thought during this difficult time that if the Arab world or the larger Muslim world realized that America was supporting the creation of a Jewish state, which was anathema to many, many Arabs, that they should then side politically, strategically, with the Soviet Union. Yes, Israel is a democracy. It still is a vibrant democracy with many, many parties, but they thought perhaps it would vote in the UN or strategically with the Soviet Union, which it hasn't. America and Israel vote almost entirely the same in the United Nations and are great supporters of each other, but they didn't really know that.
Many claims were made against Harry Truman about, quote-unquote, the Jewish vote, that one of the reasons that he offered early support of a homeland for the Jews is because he wanted the Jewish vote in the United States. I think maybe that claim even goes on today with current
office holders or those running for the office of president. Could you comment on that, please, Reba?
Almost every book mentions this, some in a positive way, some in a more critical way. Certainly there were people who, from oil-producing countries, who were lobbyists for one side, but you don't hear that as much as there was Jewish lobbying. There was intense Jewish lobbying or Zionist lobbying. I shouldn't say Jewish, because there were many, many Christians in the United States who were avid supporters of the creation of a Jewish state. In fact, Truman had belonged to one such group before he became president while he was a senator, I think, which was he started in 1935 as a senator. So, but there was very active lobbying for this. And in the United States, God bless us all, that you can do that. You can lobby on either side. The State Department was lobbying, and they were connected to interests who cared very much about oil interests. So there was lobbying from both sides, but often it's only one side that is discussed. He later on made decisions which were not at all supportive of the State of Israel in regard to the arms embargo, which he supported. As soon as the UN vote came on November 29th, there was an arms embargo of the United States to both sides in Palestine, the Arab side, the Jewish side. The Arabs in Palestine were able to get a lot of weapons from surrounding Arab countries, and as you know, there's no surrounding Jewish country, so having arms to defend themselves and to fight, unfortunately, in what happened, the War of Independence, they had to go out and look for weapons. It wasn't coming from the United States, and Truman went along with that, though it wasn't politically in, you know, for Jewish votes. Just to throw out, you may have heard of Teddy Kollek, who was mayor of Jerusalem. He actually was the arms purchaser for the new state of Israel and went around Europe looking for arms so that they could defend themselves in what was going to be a very bitter battle where 1% of the new Jewish state's population tragically died. It was a very high percentage. Teddy Kollek was especially well-received in Czechoslovakia, which gave a lot of the weapons to this new state in the 47, 48, 49 period.
Reba, let me ask a two-part question, if I may. There was more than one plan, which was partition, for the land of Palestine. One was called the UN trusteeship. So if you could comment on what that was. And then part two of this question is, what reasons did the Arabs provide in rejection of the partition plan?
Which one first? Okay. The reluctance or the refusal to have a Jewish state in the region of any part of Palestine, whether it was a small part or a larger part, was that this part should be for a Muslim state or an Arab state and not for Jews. Jews were welcome to live there, as happened in Arab countries, Jews were not on the same equal level legally as an Arab citizen. So Jews really did not want that situation to be in Palestine either. In regard to the minority plan, which was proposed by UNSCOP, United Nations Special Committee on Israel, the majority was partition, because we don't think the two sides are going to live well together. And the minority plan was there should be more of a binational country with UN supervision for 3 years, and hopefully that would work out.
We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to a discussion of how President Harry Truman came to support the creation of the State of Israel. Our guest today is Reba Gambert, the director of the Partnership for Israel of the East Bay Federation. I wanted to ask a question about the importance of Arab oil to those who oppose the partition plan. How widespread was this? How involved, how important were maybe American oil companies in lobbying Truman and the administration against partition?
I don't know about individual oil companies, so I'm not going to go there because it would be wrong for me to talk about it. But certainly the State Department and the Department of Defense, and all of us realize that energy is vital, not just to our economy, but also to our daily life. I talked about a car that, you know, the cars would be adversely affected if you didn't have oil. They didn't think about the cars we have today with Priuses. And also, of course, with military. If you didn't have oil, you wouldn't have ships being able to move around the world. You wouldn't have planes to be able to fly. So there were very legitimate reasons why you should be worried, the State Department and Defense, if oil was reduced. I mean, all of us, most of us here remember 1973, 74, with the oil embargo and sitting in your car very early in the morning hoping you'll get a tank full of gasoline. So those were real concerns, and George Marshall was very worried, legitimately so, of Soviet encroachment around the world and America not being able to do a Berlin, help out with Berlin, help out in countries which perhaps could be dominated by the Soviet Union. And so these were real concerns, and they still are today when we talk about energy.
Well, George Marshall was the General George Marshall became the Secretary of State, as you mentioned. I'm not sure you talked about James Forrestal, who was the Secretary of Defense in that Truman administration. And how vocal was he in terms of the importance of Arab oil and why we should not support Truman?
Well, they both agreed. My readings have mostly centered on Marshall and some of his predecessors, but defense and state agreed very vigorously about this. And it wasn't just oil. It was also about the fear of a communist Israel. It was the fear of throwing the Arab world towards the Soviet Union. One of the threats, one of the prophecies they made, the State Department was, and defense, was that if American security was seriously injured or hampered by American troops having to go into Palestine, go into Israel to save lives, because there would be a catastrophe, a horrible massacre, and if that weakened American security interests elsewhere in the world, they predicted that the American Jewish position would be severely harmed. In other words, there'd be great anti-Semitism in the United States. So both defense and state did mention those things. It wasn't only oil that they talked about, but many different things, and also that the Arab world would look negatively at their own population of Jews, which did indeed happen after the creation of the State of Israel and the subsequent exodus of Jews from countries in Yemen and Iraq and later countries in North Africa because of fears and because of casualties when there were riots or anti-Semitism because there was a Jewish state being created.
Reba, someone in the audience has submitted some questions that question some of the facts that you've come up with. They certainly have a right to do that. Let me just read one of the comments. It says, you state that the Arabs attacked first. My sources indicated that the Arabs only attacked after Jewish terrorist groups perpetrated several massacres. Do you want to adjust your statements at all?
No. Tragically, first of all lives are precious and all lives should be valued, and it's a tragedy that anyone has died or been injured or hurt anyway in this whole ongoing Arab Israeli conflict. So let me first state this. You cannot state who began to fight with whom exactly on what day. There were atrocities committed by Arabs against Jews and horrible things committed by some Jews against Deir Yassin and some other incidents. So it's not just one or the other. All of it is very unfortunate. However, it is known that after Israel was declared a state, very late on May 14th, that five Arab armies invaded the country. Israel did not invade an Arab country. So I'm not going to go, this way and that way. This day one person did this, and another day this person did that. During the 40, actually, hostilities began in 1921 with incidences at a place called Tel Hai, where Joseph Trumpeldor was killed, and we could go back and forth like this. All of these things, it's a shame that we can't say there's a huge Middle East. There are many Arab countries, a wonderful plethora of Arab countries, and there is one Jewish state, and it would be nice that one Jewish state can exist in security and peace, and let us hope that everyone can get along in the future and build up a region where it could be a role model for religious tolerance.
And I'll answer myself to another question from this same person, and that is, would you consider a Palestinian group coming to the Commonwealth Club to correct possible inaccuracies or to give a different side of the story? And the answer is, of course. And the answer is, we've had members of the Palestinian community come to the Commonwealth Club. So we're always open to that. That's what we do here, and we are very proud of our open forum. Reba, what is the most underestimated or misunderstood action regarding Truman and Middle Eastern policy?
Well, the interesting thing was that one of the things that was very interesting was when he had this showdown in the Oval Office on May 12th or so of 1948, he actually counseled Clark Clifford, because he wanted Clifford to be like a lawyer. George Marshall would be on one side advocating against partition, and he wanted Clifford to be his spokesperson for it, to be his voice. And he would be sort of the president, more neutral, listening to both sides. But he actually said to Clark Clifford, I'd like you to speak and research your arguments as if you're speaking to the Supreme Court. Which he did. And one of the things that happened, George Marshall, who Truman adored, he really respected George Marshall. This was a very tense meeting on May 12th. And Clifford, when Marshall walked into the meeting room, the Oval Office, and saw Clifford, knowing that Clifford was an ardent Zionist, he said, "What are you doing here?" And because he wasn't happy to see him, and Truman said, he's here because I said he should be here." So that's a little unknown thing.
How do you think President Truman will be remembered today in Israel itself?
He's remembered very, very well. There's a Truman Center of Research. Eddie Jacobson, his longtime friend, there's a building named after him. He died tragically very soon afterwards in 1955, I think of a heart attack, but I'm not 100% positive. He's remembered very well, because when America was the first country to recognize, even de facto, the State of Israel, this made was like a role model for other countries to step up and recognize the new country. Had America not done so, maybe some countries would say, why aren't they? Russia, the Soviet Union also recognized Israel. And the interesting thing was that Great Britain, when they threw the issue of Palestine to the UN in 1947, many people really think that Great Britain hoped that the UN committee, UNSCOP, would say, "We don't have an answer, it's unsolvable, England, keep it forever. Don't, you know, just go ahead." And the reason was that one of the British members of government said, as an aside, "Well, don't worry, the United States and Russia will never agree on anything and they won't vote in the same way." So they thought that they would come on conflicting sides, and therefore without these two superpowers agreeing to Resolution 181, it would fall apart, and Great Britain would maintain a mandate or trusteeship of the region into the future.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where there's time for one last question, although we do have a few minutes left. So I'm going to make it your favorite, a two-part question again. Please describe the three zones established by UN Resolution 181. And the second part, which is related, what is the underlying consideration, a member of the audience wants to know, for the sporadic layout of the partition plan in 1947-1948? And how could this evolve into a viable state plan? I'm going to assume the person means a two-state solution plan, but it doesn't say that. It says evolve into a viable state plan. So it's a continuum of the initial partition into present time, when the discussion of a two-state solution seems to be always on the table.
Well, the overwhelming majority of American Jews and also of Israelis believe in a two-state solution. Some people would say there's a three-state solution, but that's been very cynical. Originally, Palestine was included what is today Jordan, and that was partitioned off around 1921, and then there was left with the remaining part of Palestine. The majority of American Jews and, as I said, Israelis believe and hope that one day there'll be a Palestinian state that accepts Israel's right to exist as a neighbor, and that will be sooner than later. Many of us were very, very optimistic when Oslo came in 1993 with the late prime minister and one of my heroes, Yitzhak Rabin, former prime minister of Israel. And for whatever reason, Oslo has not succeeded. Oslo was supposed to create a trust between Palestinian Arabs and Israelis, and unfortunately, still today, there is fear. I'm not Palestinian, but probably there is fear also on the Palestinian Arab side that there's not sincerity and fear of terrorism on the Israeli side. So that's, I think, what I could say.
Okay, that's great. Our thanks to Reva Gambert for her comments today, and we also thank our audiences here as well as those listening on the radio and the Internet. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm president of Sierra Steel Trading and a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating over 109 years, are we at 110 yet? 110 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you very much.
You did great.